Like to welcome everybody to the December 18th, 2025 City of Savannah Zoning Board of Appeals. This is a quasi-judicial proceeding. All those wishing to give testimony during these proceedings will please sign in, and witnesses will be sworn in prior to giving testimony. All proceedings of the Savannah ZBA are final. All decisions are recorded. Challenges to decisions of the Savannah Zoning Board of Appeals must be filed through the Superior Court of Chatham County. If you have any cell phones or noise-making devices, please turn them off at this time. If you will, join me for the prayer and the Pledge of Allegiance. Father, we just thank you for this morning to gather here to do the business of this city. Lord, we ask that you bless these proceedings. Give us wisdom to make good and right decisions that would be pleasing to you and justice to be served. Lord, we just pray and ask your blessings on the city of Savannah and Chatham County and Lord, on every marriage and every family here, in Jesus' name, amen. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. If you are planning to speak or give testimony here today, would you please stand up? Raise your right hand, repeat after me. I do solemnly swear to tell the truth. The whole truth. Nothing but the truth. So help me God. Thank you. Okay, first we're going to have the approval of the minutes from the October 23rd, 2025 meeting of Savannah Zoning Board of Appeals. Is there a motion to approve the minutes?
Motion.
Motion made by Mr. Condon to approve the minutes. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Mr. Ball. Mr. Ball, how do you vote?
Yes.
Mr. Condon?
Yes.
Mr. Turner?
Yes.
And Mr. Griffith?
Yes.
All right, motion passes and the minutes are approved. Next, we want to approve the agenda as we see it before you. Is there a motion for that?
I'd like to make a motion that we visit item number 3, 2024 East Oglethorpe Avenue, prior to visiting item number 2, 502 Virginia Avenue.
And otherwise approve the agenda?
And otherwise approve the agenda.
Okay. Mr. Condon has made a motion to approve the agenda with the stipulation that we switch items 2 and 3 in order. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Mr. Turner. Mr. Griffith, how do you vote?
Yes.
Mr. Turner?
Yes.
Mr. Condon?
Yes.
Mr. Ball?
Yes.
Okay. First, we're going to hear 20 through 24 East Oglethorpe Avenue, appeal to a decision of the Historic District Board of Review, 25-004707.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the Zoning Board of Appeals. Looking for a presentation. It's not there. Sorry. Okay. Not going to talk for Mr. Jones' slides either. My apologies. As you know, we had a little bit of a mix-up. This is an item that is returning to this board for a an appeal of the part two of the COA. So in the previous version of this request, it was an appeal of the approval, the HTBR's approval of part one related to height and mass. This is an appeal of part two, design details. I'm going to go through some of these just to kind of refresh everyone about what happened. So Ballastone Inn, represented by Mr. Andrew Jones, is making application to this board, appealing the HTBR's September 10th approval, which granted the part two design details portion of the COA. Again, the original petition was appealed based on the board's approval on May 14th of the part one of the COA. At that time, the appellant brought forth an argument that the HDBR had erred in its decision, and it was supported in that decision by MPC staff and the petitioner who provided misleading details. And so, in essence, this board, in its initial review, determined that the issuance of part one of the COA was valid, that the HDBR had acted in its authority, and not only that, that there was no malfeasance on the part of MPC staff or the petitioner. Today, the petitioner is alleging in extension that there was no logical connection between its approval, the HDBR's approval of part two, because part one was invalid, in essence, for the previously mentioned reasons. And MPC staff, in its review, found that because part one was deemed to be valid by this board, as long as all of the relevant criteria were reviewed for part two, the only thing that would be required is that this particular petition meet the requirements of the part two review. In staff's review, we did also find that MPC historic staff applied all of the relevant details and criteria and that the proposal met all of those. On that basis, MPC staff does recommend that the decision of the HDBR be affirmed and upheld. The appellant is here, as well as representation for the recipient of the COA. I am here to answer any questions you all may have, but you're going to hear lots of verbiage about this case today, so just know staff is here to answer any questions.
Anybody want to ask Mr. Morrow anything? All right. Thank you very much. Mr. Jones, would you like to come forward?
Good morning. My name is Andrew Jones. I'm an attorney with Thomerson Jones and Edwards. I represent the Ballastone Inn property, and this is the appeal of 24004958 COA. And to clarify, our position is a bit different from that described by Mr. Morrow, and I'll explain in more detail why. We are appealing all three decisions together because of a recent court case that treats those three decisions as one proceeding, and I'll explain. The record in this case includes the appeal application form and the supplemental documentation, which is 44 pages. And has everyone here read, or let me ask it the other way, which of you has actually read all 44 pages of the supplemental documentation? Anybody who's read all 44 pages? Okay, we'll let the record show that no member of the board has stated that they've read all 44 pages. The appeal record also includes exhibits A through X, and that includes the architect's submittal packet, which is, you know, the basic evidence of the facts, and certified copies of the pertinent ordinances. So you have the law that you need certified by the city. And then, of course, this PowerPoint presentation. And we hereby submit the foregoing documents to the record for each of the COA and ZBA proceedings. And this oral presentation incorporates by reference all the facts and all the arguments contained in the foregoing documents. So there are a lot of arguments in those 44 pages. And I don't think that if I went through all those arguments, by the time I get to the last one, you probably won't remember what the first one is. So I think it makes most sense for me here to incorporate those by reference and focus on a couple of specific issues that you can concentrate on. Action by the Zoning Board of Appeals under 3.26, your findings of fact shall be based on the same evidence received by the first decision maker. So there probably will be a lot of evidence discussed here today. It gives some color, but ultimately what the HDBR looked at were the submittal packets and the law. Sometimes in some of these proceedings, after the testimony is closed, the board asks additional questions, effectively opening up new testimony. If that happens, that I would like to reserve the right of rebuttal, the rule of completion. If somebody says something to you that's accurate, I should at least have the last word to offer my side of that particular issue. I would appreciate that. So The appellant is the Ballastone Inn. This is a montage of East Oglethorpe between Bull Street here at the left, which is the west, and the proposed building on the right, which is a Drayton Street. And the far left, of course, is the Julia Gordon Low Birthplace, important Savannah monument. And the two buildings in between, one's late 19th century, one is mid 19th century. Those are owned by my client. The Ballastone has traditionally been in number 14. The new owners purchased that building and the building next door, invested $14 million in renovations, and it's now been redubbed the Douglas. And they're concerned that this new proposal is too massive and too tall. And if you look, this is what they will be facing. This is the lot line wall. So it's over 70 feet deep. It's 68 feet high. And that section in the center here, these are setbacks, but this whole section here is just a big windowless wall. I'm going to jump ahead to a slide that shows you what happened in terms of what you're looking at from hearing to hearing. So the May 14th HDBR decision approved this building on the left. Now, of course, the windows and all look different because that was part one. It wasn't about the design details. It was about the massing and the height. And this is the HDBR decision, page 5. Now, there is a lot of testimony in that hearing about additional mass and bulk of the stair tower and so on. But this is what is in the decision. It's this decision that I'm appealing, not the oral testimony of that hearing. I'm appealing what was signed as a decision. And this is the picture that was chosen. Also, in the last ZBA hearing, this same drawing was included. Was included and marked by the MPC staff as the HDBR approved drawing. And I believe it is also the drawing that is in today's MPC table. So if you take that drawing, you can see it's got a roofline variation here. There's a whole step down towards my client's property. But by the time we got through part two, there's that massive elevator shaft. Now, there's a lot of confusion in the May hearing about whether or not that was approved, but in the decision, it's not there, but it is in this building. So that is a matter of height. That's a matter of mass. So that means that even if you weren't looking at the three hearings together as one piece, that this effectively reopened the whole question of height and mass. But a lot has happened since then. We appealed your last ruling to Superior Court, and the Superior Court dismissed it but issued a decision that has lots of implications, and we're not quite sure what those implications are. We, after that, we issued a motion for clarification to the court because right now the process is extremely unclear of what the proper appeal path is. And part of the issue is that, as you know, the city ordinance provides for certiorari to Superior Court. Well, under state law, certiorari was eliminated in 2022. So we have a whole process in the city ordinance that hasn't kept up with state law, and specifically it's Georgia Code 36-33-5.1D, which provides a whole mechanism for appealing a quasi-judicial decision to Superior Court. So the reason the court dismissed it is they said the part one COA is not a final decision, that the whole HDBR proceeding is one proceeding. And this is a change from the position the city took and the way that we always were practicing appeals. It used to be you took the COA part one to the ZBA, and then you file with Superior Court, and then you take COA part two, go to ZBA, file with Superior Court, and merge the two. That's not the law anymore. And this is state law. This is a Superior Court. So that's why I'm here today. Effectively, they are saying that you don't have a final COA decision until the part two is approved. So that is the law now. which then means that the last time we were here, we technically weren't supposed to be here. Now, we all thought that that was the proper process. City thought it was the proper process. We thought it was the proper process because that was prior to the court decision. So technically, you didn't have jurisdiction, to our surprise, because it wasn't a final written decision. As you can see in 3.23, your authority is over a final written decision. So we're here today with a final written decision, which means that we have to address everything from the very beginning all the way through to the Part 2 hearing, which is also why I'm only going to focus on a couple of discrete issues, because there'd be far too much. So I'm here today to address Part 1 and 2 together, in part because the building changed, but also because the court has rendered this decision that changes the law. And we have not received any responses on our motion for clarification. So what we've had to do is file this proceeding both in Superior Court and here at the ZBA, because we simply do not know which one. We don't know if you have jurisdiction over these. And the reason is that this same code section, and this law, again, is just about 2 years old, adopts case law that goes back for many, many years. And that case law had a process for appealing a quasi-judicial decision. So the ZBA's decisions are quasi-judicial decisions. Those go to Superior Court. Well, what the judge did in the decision is determine that the HDBR is a lower judicatory. Traditionally, the city always said the HDBR is an administrative body. Therefore, appeals go to the ZBA. Now the court is saying that they're a quasi-judicatory, which implies that all appeals should be going right to Superior Court, not to the ZBA, because the definition of quasi-judicial board is one that hears appeals of administrative decisions. It doesn't hear appeals of other quasi-judicial entities. This issue is before Superior Court right now. So on the left is the petition that we filed. Opposing counsel filed a motion to dismiss, as you would expect, alleging that we should go through the ZBA. And then we filed a response that says, but there are four or five reasons why we didn't think that was appropriate. But one was that under these new laws, it appears you go directly to Superior Court. So we're in Superior Court right now with a pending motion. I suspect that there'll be a hearing in January or February. And that would determine whether we should be here today or not. Now, I had asked the city for a continuance because of this issue. It seems inappropriate to hold this hearing if the validity of this hearing is subject to a court decision where the motion is pending right now. The city gave us 1 month, but they would not grant a further continuance. And typically a continuance is for 90 days, but that's usually for practical issues of, you know, not being ready or something factually changing. Here it's a jurisdictional issue. And I would think that you should give some consideration to continuing this to when the court finally makes a decision. So the court's going to do one of two things, I'm guessing. One, they could say they could agree with this motion to dismiss, say you've got to go to the ZBA, we'll come back here. Or you go ahead and have the hearing. The other thing the court could do is just say that the ZBA no longer has authority under the new law for to review an HDBR decision, in which case I wouldn't come back. You wouldn't see me again. If you do rule today, what that means is that then we would be appealing today's ruling, assuming you rule against us, to the Superior Court in a third petition. And then the Superior Court would have petition number two and petition number three and decide which one it wanted to proceed on. Obviously, this is getting a little expensive for my client. We can't get any clarification of what this rule is. We've asked the court. Our preference would be that you would continue this until the court renders a decision. And depending upon that decision, we decide whether we come back here and present or not. But assuming that that's not something you want to address, I'll move ahead with the arguments. Ordinance section 3.23 says that the Zoning Board of Appeals shall determine whether the first decision maker erred in the application or interpretation of this ordinance. So did the HDBR err in how they apply the law to the facts, and did they err in quoting the ordinance or determining what the ordinance meant? An error of law is an abuse of discretion. The HDBR does not have the discretion to change the law or rewrite it or apply it in the wrong way. That is an abuse of discretion. I know that you're concerned about granting the HDBR discretion, but for them to not follow the law is not within their purview of discretion. And that's backed by years and years of case law, of cases that go up, zoning cases that go up through Superior Court. In terms of interpretation of the ordinance, and that is what you are doing, you make an independent determination. Obviously, the MPC has their determination, but you make your determination, and then the Superior Court will make its own independent interpretation. The cardinal rule is to ascertain and give effect to the intention of the lawmaking body, and the three provisions that I'll be discussing today actually have an explicit intent set forth in the ordinance. And the other thing is that where the language of the ordinance is plain and unambiguous, it's the sole evidence of legislative intent. So you need to look to the plain language of the ordinance. The intent of the design standard. So this is section 7.810, and I'll be discussing three provisions in it. It says in the second sentence that the design standards are not intended to promote copies of the architectural designs of the past, but to encourage contemporary designs that protect and complement existing contributing resources. So the goal is to protect the contributing resources. Those are the buildings that my client owns. They're not supposed to be protecting the new building. So this is really different from traditional zoning law. Traditional zoning law, you defer to the right of the property owner to develop the property the way they want to. That's your assumption going forward. That's not what this is. This is a law that has imposed, as a matter of law, a different intent. And your determination must be independent. Testimony by public officials as to what the ordinance means is not relevant. And that's within Georgia case law. That's, you cannot rely just on MPC staff to interpret the ordinance. You could agree with them, but it is your own independent interpretation. So just asking the MPC what it means is not sufficient. You need to look at the plain language of the law and come to your own conclusion. So the first argument I'll address is that the proposal does not comply with the lane rule in ordinance section 7810T32. This is part of the large scale development standards. The MPC did treat this building as a large scale development. The ordinance says, in DN and DR zoning districts, the building footprint shall occupy a minimum of 50% of the lot width along the lane. What the HDBR decision says is in DC and DR zoning districts, the building footprint shall occupy a minimum of 50%. So they misquoted the legal standard. It's material here because this building is in a DN zoning district. So you can look at the certified copy of the law. You can look at the HDBR decision from May 14th, page 16. You can look at the MPC staff report on page 16, and you'll find this language. So they misquoted the legal standard, and this is obviously a very serious problem with the decision. I think you all know what the definition of footprint is. It's the area at the finished grade within the exterior faces of the exterior walls. So parking spaces don't count. And this building is maxed out at approximately 75% lot coverage. That's in the HDBR decision. Its footprint covers the southern portion of the lot, leaving the lane frontage, the northern part, as parking space.
Mr. Jones, I'm sorry to interrupt. I have a question for the chair.
Go ahead.
If the petitioner's primary request is for a continuance, should we discuss whether the board is open to that before we let him give an entire?
That was going to be my first thing to talk to y'all about after he was finished, before we called any more testimony.
Well, to say if he's asking for a continuance and we would, and the members of the board are open to that, should we just grant it to him before making him go through the entire presentation?
If it's unclear,
hear from the other side,
whether or not we even have jurisdiction over this until the court makes a decision, it's so far, I'd be interested to see what staff says about that. But That's up to y'all. You want to make a motion or you want to continue one or the other. We got to get.
I appreciate hearing the thoughts from the other board members and from staff, I guess. Sorry to interrupt. Mike.
Mr. Jones, the Superior Court dismissed the prior case. Is that correct, sir?
That's correct. But a new petition has been filed.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
They dismissed it because
they dismissed the first one because they didn't have jurisdiction because it wasn't this COA Part 2 decision hadn't been handed down yet. And the reason that we had to file the first one is there's a 30-day limit on both Superior Court decisions and the ZBA decision. So we can't gamble our clients' rights away. We have to do this double process until we're told what the correct process is.
My concern is that that everybody's here today. The other side has put together a package to present to us as well. If we don't give them the opportunity to present, I think we might even create more of a complication for ourselves. We can always.
They had no choice but to be here because he had no choice but to be here.
Correct.
But right now, whose court the ball is in, it seems to be nobody knows that.
I rather doubt that the court is going to. I mean, I'm not telling you what the court is going to do. But, you know, based on historical evidence, we have the right to hear these cases.
Let's hear it.
So that's my only thing, Stephen.
Mr. Ball?
I mean, I think there are other legal opinions that will be rendered here today that I'd like to hear before we delay this further.
I think it's a very valid question, though, Stephen.
Please continue.
I would only add to your discussion that, yes, historically, it was true you had jurisdiction. The law's changed, and it's a new law and hasn't been interpreted. We just don't know what way the courts are going to come out on it. So on the left, you've got the image of the building, the footprint. So Oglethorpe Avenue is at the bottom. The lane is at the top. There are parking spaces there. And figure 7.85 is the figure that accompanies this provision about the lane rule. And you can see it shows that this in the hatching that the building occupies 50% of the lane. Since MPC staff used the wrong zoning district, there'd be no reason to even do this analysis. So, okay. So, you know, if you're quoting the ordinance incorrectly and you're excluding the zoning district this is in, there's a reason why the HDBR and the MPC didn't apply this rule. But that was a mistake. I don't know how the mistake happened, but it was a mistake. And this is a rule that needs to be applied. And it was not applied, and it looks like the building does not comply. And this is material because there's also a restriction in height standards for large-scale development. On the right, you see that the maximum height on the lane can only be two stories for 20 feet. And if you wonder what's going on here, think about what a DN and DR is. DR is very residential. So in the historic district, a lot of the formations, a townhouse, a small garden, and a carriage house. So, and in a DN, you have a mix. You've got some residential, some commercial. So what they're doing here is trying to make sure that new construction echoes that volume of a two-story building on the lane, as opposed to having a six-story facade right on an alley. So what that then means is that the current building needs to be redesigned in terms of moving some of its mass around, some of its footprint. So on the left is what it is now. So what they're going to have to do to meet the lane rule is have a two-story addition on the lane, right, going halfway down. And since they've got a 75% lot coverage, they're going to have to subtract the same amount from somewhere else. Just the red is just randomly put there. They can do whatever they need to meet the building footprint. But what that means is that if they gain two but lose six, that's a net loss of four stories of approximately 800 square feet of floor. So that's about 3,200 square feet. So it is a material difference. And obviously it would ultimately have visual impact as well. So as to this rule, the HCBR misquoted the ordinance, which explains why we are where we are today. And if you do apply the rule, it requires that the building go through some redesign. Second argument is that the proposal does not comply with the roofline variation rule in table 7.8.1. We actually just saw that table, and it's incorporated into the large scale development rules through this section 7810 TV. Now, just to clarify, because things can get confusing, the large scale development rules have a whole bunch of rules about mass. And one of those is called the roofline variation rule. And then there is height, and height has a separate roofline variation rule. So I'm not talking about the rule in the mass section, I'm talking about the one that's just in the height section. And why they use different language, I don't know. So this is the table that applies in the height section. And it says the maximum frontage of 60 linear feet of continuous height shall be permitted before a minimum one-half story variation is required. This variation shall be expressed in the roof line. They have a little picture there. And basically, the building's high, steps down, goes back up. And again, this is DN and DR zoning districts. The proposal does not comply, so the ordinance says exactly what we saw before. And the HDBR decision says a maximum frontage of 120 linear feet of continuous height shall be permitted. So that's not the rule. I think what happened was they picked up the bottom line, all other zoning districts. But this is not all other zoning districts. This is DN. So there's a mistake, again, that the wrong standard was quoted. Well, obviously, you're going to have very different conclusions for different legal standards. And also, the HDBR decision, now, so this, they, it's not just that they quoted it wrong, but then this is, they determined that the standard was met because the proposed design of the building would include variations in the roof line. Standard is a one-half story variation, just vague variations doesn't cut it. So as you saw in the last slide, they quoted the wrong standard. They're using the wrong test. There's got to be a one-half story variation. And there are no variations in the roof line. And now there are two frontages to look at. One is the Oglethorpe Avenue facade. We can go through that if you want to. But it's just simpler to look at the Drayton Street facade. Mechanicals are not considered part of the roof. And they don't factor into roof line variation. And this is the final Drayton Street facade that was approved, and you can see that it is a straight line. There's no variation there. That is a 71-foot frontage, so it's greater than the 60 feet. If you apply the wrong standard and you're looking at 120 feet, it's fine, but that's not the standard. That wasn't the test. So there was a mistake there. I'm sure that there'll be counter arguments to this presented by the other side, and I will offer rebuttals at the appropriate time. The third argument is that the proposal does not comply with the building form rule in section 7810C2. So the building form is the physical shape of a building resulting from its height, mass, and envelope. So we know what height is, we know what mass is. Envelope, think of it as the geometric skin of a building. So a proposed building located on an east-west through street shall utilize a contributing building form fronting the same street within the same ward or in an adjacent ward. So the HDBR actually did quote that part correctly, but they followed it up with language saying the proposed building form is one that is seen in the ward and adjacent ones in the downtown area. Well, that's not the test. It's got to be on Oglethorpe Avenue. That's very clear. All over the downtown area doesn't matter. And the building form has to be a contributing building. You can't look at new construction as an example. And the HDB also didn't even cite what the building is that they're talking about. I mean, if you're going to use a building form, you need to cite a specific building and tell us what its height is, tell us what its mass is, and show us what its envelope is. So again, the HDBR applied the wrong test. Same street versus downtown area, contributing building versus just any building. And the applicant offered no evidence to the HDBR of a qualifying building form, a building form on the same street, in the same or adjacent ward with proof of its height, mass, and envelope. So if we go back to that photo montage of the buildings on that stretch of Oglethorpe, the largest one is the Julia Gordon Lowe birthplace. If you superimpose that, you get a smaller building. Ironically, they aggregated the two lots. They would have been in better shape if they had left them as two separate buildings, because then they could have had a building form on each lot. That would have given them a lot more mass, but they chose not to go that direction. And this would lower the building's height. And of course, these are design standards. You can apply for exceptions, special exceptions to the design standards. And you've seen special exceptions here, but they didn't do that. So they're without a special exception, they simply don't comply. Across the street's a really big building, the Board of Education. It's massive, occupies the entire city block. So I don't think that they're arguing that they're using that building form because it wouldn't fit on their property. The mass is too big. In terms of its envelope, you can see it's a cruciform building. So if they were using that as the envelope, they'd need to imitate the way that that building cuts in the corners. And if they were using it for height, then, as you see in the next slide, if I can get there, then this is on the Drayton Street side, you would end up having to have, if you're using the envelope and the height, you're going to have a sloped roof to be within that envelope, and you're going to have to be a bit lower, which probably is going to involve, you know, eliminating a floor or having some kind of dormers or something else, whatever the architect figures out. Or they apply for a special exception from the building form rule. So in conclusion, the decision should be overturned. They just need to come back with a revised design, maybe some requests for special exceptions. The lane rule, the HDBR misquoted the legal standard. I mean, that's just clear. And feel free to take time to go to all the exhibits are attached. I can point to you where the language is. They simply misquoted it. And the proposal does not comply with the rule. Roofline variation, again, they misquoted the legal standard, made a mistake. And the proposal does not comply with the rule. And the building form rule, the HDBR applied the wrong test. They quoted it correctly, but they made up a new test that basically gutted the rule. And the proposal doesn't comply with the rule. And there's no evidence. HDBR had no evidence of an eligible form. So there would be no way to draw a rational conclusion on this section. So I'll stop with that. Obviously, as I said, the other side will have different interpretations, and I'll have some rebuttals, and we'll see where we come out.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. Oh,
any questions?
Are there any questions for Mr. Jones?
No. Thank you.
All right. I'm not sure who to call on next, but I know there's who's here to speak for the opposition? Mr. Yellen, would you like to come forward, or?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Harold Yellen. I represent Oglethorpe Avenue LLC, who are the owners of 2024 Oglethorpe Avenue. Also with me today is Andy Lynch, who's the project architect. And forgive me, I've got the crud going around, and I'm going to do my best not to give anyone else the same crud. Edward, could you help me get to that one? Thank you. I thought it would be helpful, and I'm going to address process. I'm not an architect, so I'm going to simply address the legal process. It would be helpful to show you both the approvals that the property owner has received and to show you all of the appeals which have been filed by Mr. Jones on behalf of Battlestone Inn. You can see on the far left, on February the 12th, HDBR did approve the demolition of this property as a non-contributing structure. It also approved the recombination of lots, which is now a requirement that it go to HDBR. Both of these were approved February the 12th. We came back on May the 14th for part one height and mass. Excuse me. HDBR approved part one. Mr. Jones appealed that decision to ZBA. Many of you may recall that Mr. Jones alleged, among other things, the appearance of fraud. He alleged the appearance of collusion on the part of MPC staff. This board, and many of you were on the board at the time, approved unanimously, 5-0. You approved unanimously to deny the appeal. And as we expected, Mr. Jones appealed that to Superior Court, as the chart shows. Over the objections of Mr. Jones and his client, the presiding judge in that case, the Superior Court judge, ruled that despite the appeal of part one, the property owner could proceed with part two height and mass, which is exactly what we did. On September the 10th, HDBR, I'd like to add, unanimously approved part two design. As expected, Mr. Jones, on behalf of his client, appealed. But what was not expected is that he appealed to both the ZBA and to Superior Court. Not quite sure that I understand that, even despite the previous comments made by Mr. Jones. So once again, we are hearing, it's a record we've been hearing for a long time. We're hearing that members of HDBR abused their discretion. We're hearing again that they could not possibly have arrived at a decision to approve part two design. It's just, they just couldn't have done it. That's odd to me because in my opinion, the only thing before you is design. Mr. Jones wants to revisit height and mass all over again to get you to continue this matter, and there's simply no need. The only thing before you today is design, and despite Mr. Jones's efforts to re-argue, I think I heard height and mass 6, 7, 8 times in this presentation. The only thing before you is design, and I'm honestly not sure how you abuse the discretion on matters of design. The appellant may not like our design, but HDBR did, and they unanimously approved our design. In fact, 2 of the 5 who approved our design are architects in the city of Savannah. I would urge this board to do what it did on July 24th. Deny this appeal, or if you prefer, call this a denial of both appeals. If that will satisfy Mr. Jones, at least there'll be clarity. But you should absolutely deny this appeal. Let it go to Superior Court because that is where it belongs. It does not belong here anymore. It belongs in Superior Court. We should let a judge decide if any of the, and there are numerous allegations, and I can only call them allegations. I don't know the proof of anything that Mr. Jones has raised. Let a judge decide if any of the numerous allegations have any merit at all. That's the role of a judge in Superior Court. So I would respectfully support the staff recommendation before you today. And the staff recommendation is also for a denial of this appeal. And I'm happy to answer any questions you may have. And the project architect is also here. And if it's all right with you, I'm going to.
Any questions for Mr. Jones? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Jones.
Thank you. I'll be right back.
Mr. Lynch, are you going to speak?
Good afternoon. I'm Andy Lynch with Lynch Associates Architects. I'm really just here to answer any questions you might have on the part two submission. As Mr. Yellen said, most of these issues that are raised today are part one issues. I did want to clarify two of these points regarding the lane frontage issue. That was a standard that was implemented after our initial submission. And so we were already in process with our project prior to that. I believe standard started in November of 2024. Our submission was initially in September of 2024. That was in November of 2024.
So you're saying that was not part of the ordinance?
It was not part of the ordinance when we started the project. Pardon? Yes, sir. And then, so I don't know if there's, Kaylin can probably clarify that more than I can. And regarding the roof line variation issue on Drayton Street, that was not a standard that we used. We were only using the base metal top and facade setback guideline as part of the large scale development. So we didn't use roof line variation on that facade anyway. So that wasn't a standard that we were even contemplating. So I just wanted to clarify that because it was a little muddy.
Question for you, Mr. Yes, Lynch. Sorry to interrupt you in the middle. But the roof line variation, that's not a requirement. It's an optional thing is what your position
is? It's part of the large scale development guideline. So we use that guideline on the Oglethorpe facade along with base metal top, but it was not a requirement that we had to use all the way around the building. We talked to staff about that when we were developing the project. So we used it on one facade, but not on the other side.
Your position is that you used it on the facade that you were required to use it on, but
yes,
not use it on the facades that you were not required to use.
Correct.
It on. Thank you.
And that was the understanding of when it was approved by HBR.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Before we call any more witnesses, Caitlin, can you clarify some things? The first of all, the zoning DN and DR that Mr. Jones was saying, and that he said that y'all misquoted that. Can you speak to that?
There was a Scrivener's error in the ordinance that I believe the city may have corrected. There was no reason that DC and DR should have ever been together. Jonathan Mellon, who wrote this report and was the director at the time, was aware this was DN. I have his 20-page report in my hand. The zoning at the top says DN. He used the DN zoning standards throughout. So that was a Scrivener's error that I believe has since been corrected. But
okay. And as far as the 50% rule that we've been talking about, what Mr. Jones read the ordinance as it is now. What was the ordinance when this decision was made? What did it read? When the application went in.
I'm probably going to have to go back and look at that. Honestly, it's
okay. Yeah, it seems to be pretty important.
Yeah.
Can you find that maybe? And because we're going to need to see that.
Yeah. All right.
All right. And any other witnesses?
Thank you, Ms. Kaylin.
Any other witnesses? Any other members of the public wish to speak? All right. I think Mr. Jones, would you like to make a rebuttal?
Certainly. Let's see. I'm going to need to go into the agenda to help you guys out. And again, all of the statutes have been provided for you.
Thank you.
And I'm going to try to go in as where most of the languages, and let me go to an index I created so I can go immediately to what you need to look at. It is '84 here. There was an amendment to correct a Scrivener's error. A Scrivener's error is an error that was never intended, and under the law, it doesn't matter if that error was there when you applied. It's the effect is retroactive, and there's a huge body of case law on what a Scrivener's error is. So this is a certified copy of the amendment. The language here in the DN and DR zoning district, that was corrected. This is November, but it's a Scrivener's error, so it's a retroactive change. And I also have Bridget Liddy's memo about why this was done. DC is the most commercial. DR is the most residential. DN's in between. So if you're going to have these restrictive measures against large-scale development, it makes no sense to have them at the two extremes and not in the middle. They meant for the areas that were residential, wholly or partly. So that is the amendment. And then the chart that I referred to, the same change happened. So it's a Scrivener's error. It is retroactive. It was published. That was the notice. We have Bridget Liddy's explanation that it was a Scrivener's error. And obviously, this was all passed by City Council. That was passed in November. Now, what I'll want to do is talk about the applications. So first of all, it's a Scrivener's error, so it wouldn't matter when the applications were, but
certification date is towards the top of the document, just so I can write down the date.
Oh, sure. Do you want the one for the amendment?
This amendment that we're discussing right
now. Yeah. And you have also the memo. This, June 12th. But it's dated, you know, the amendment itself is dated in November. Now I'm going to need to go back to the agenda, and we'll look at the application. So this is a second argument. I mean, the fact that it's a Scrivener's error is determinative of what your position should be. But just for the benefit of making sure that everything is complete here, we will go to the applications that were discussed. And I'm going to go to page 116. So there were a number of applications filed. The first one was, in fact, in September, almost there. And here's the application, and it's an application by Butch Ross. Who's Butch Ross? He was a hotel developer. So the first problem with this application is it doesn't have the property owner. Property owner is, in fact, Oglethorp Avenue LLC. The other thing is that this happened in September. They scheduled a hearing in October. And I can show you that schedule if you want of hearings. And they continued it to November, and then it didn't happen in December, and it didn't happen in January. So it was beyond its 90-day expiration. So then they had to file a new application. That application was filed January 8th. So this is the application that they filed on January the 1st, again with the wrong owner. So this new application was filed, and in the February 12th hearing, I pointed out that it wasn't a valid application because it didn't have the owner on it. Whereupon a third application was filed. And the January and the February are well after the November amendment date. And the building will look completely different by this time anyway. Finally, they filed one that actually had the owner on it, Oglethorp Avenue LLC. And they backdated it. So it actually was February the 12th that this was filed, and I included the email from Jonathan Mellon to me that confirms that the application for the February 12th hearing, actually technically it was filed, I believe, after the hearing, but they accepted it anyway. So February is well after November, just to clarify that, but it actually doesn't matter because it was a Scrivener's error, not a change in the law.
This is February the 12th, 2025.
Yeah. The argument is that all of my arguments are part one arguments. Well, they are, except for the fact the building did change. It's now clearly got a stair tower that was not in the decision. And since that's a big change in mass and height, decision to decision, that reopened the height and mass. In fact, the main argument for part two is you can't approve a building in part two that's got a bigger mass than the building that was approved for height and mass in part one. Otherwise, what's the point of having a part one hearing at all? The roof line, he was discussing different options. Well, again, that's confusing the issue because ordinance has two separate sections in the large scale development for mass and height. And he is correct that under the mass provisions, the design standards now toward the bottom. Cursor's very sensitive, so whoops, I'm already past it. Okay, large scale development. Footprint, we discussed that one. Mass. In my presentation, I didn't address any of these sections. Here's where you get to choose all sorts of different options. You can divide horizontally, you can do setbacks, and here's a roof variation rule, a separate one that I did not address. What I'm addressing is after you finish up mass, they've got to meet a whole nother set of standards on height. That's part five here. And that's got its own table, the table you saw earlier, that talks about continuous height. There is nothing in here that says it only applies to one facade. Nothing in here. And this building's got two facades. But we can go to the Oglethorpe facade. Take a look at that. It just gets a little bit more complicated. All you need to know is that the Drayton Street facade doesn't work, but okay. Here's the Oglethorpe Avenue facade, the final one, not the one earlier that clearly did have a roofline variation. I mean, that one did. It stepped down towards my client's property. Here you've got this windowless six-story mass. You've got these setbacks here. Now, we had argued that these were roof terraces, and the applicant went to the MPC, went then to planning, to John Anagnost, and that's in Exhibit O. There's a long memo about roof decks and terraces and all that, and their guidance is that while they were looking at these kind of protruding balconies that that are on top of a structure as opposed to out on brackets. And with respect to these decks, they said, well, the deck is effectively the roof of the story below. It is not necessarily the true roof of the building. So that's the guidance that's there. Obviously, you don't have to follow that guidance, but that's the guidance. So these little things are not considered roofs. And so if you do look at the roof up here, again, it's continuous. Yes, there's a corner bite taken out of the building, but that doesn't change the roof line. So a roof line variation is a significant change in the upper outline of the building, not intermediate outlines that jiggle up and down, but the upper outline of the building. And the upper outline of this building on this side, just like on Drayton, is just a straight line. There's also the definitions of roof line if you need those. So those are addressing the architect's rebuttals. Those are all important points to address. And so the bottom line is that all these provisions I cited were applicable at the time of the February application, which is the application that they were considering in February, May, and September. There were updated drawings in August for the final finished details. As to Mr. Yellen's arguments, he said that the HDBR decision, last decision, was unanimous. They were at that point just looking at the design details. They took the position that it didn't matter that the building had a different height and mass because they knew it did already. And so there was testimony from Karen Gwynn, oh, well, we knew that it had that tower there. Well, my response was, if you knew it had the tower there, then why did you approve the decision that showed a different building? Take the decision, don't sign it, send it back to MPC staff and have them put the proper drawings in place. Because this would be a mess if I had to come up here and my entire appeal would be of oral testimony. I've got to appeal a decision, not oral testimony. Harold is saying that it's inappropriate to revisit height and mass. Well, it's not if you read the judge's decision. The judge makes it clear that you have to wait until the end to talk about everything that happened, including the subdivision. That was not the rule traditionally, and Harold's absolutely right. That's not the way things were done. But the city made the argument that they were separate proceedings, and the judge rejected that argument. The city made the argument that the HDBR was administrative, and the judge rejected that argument. So very interesting. We each made arguments, and the judge took some of ours and some of theirs and came up with a result that actually is probably the correct result. I mean, neither side appealed it, but it was a surprise. It doesn't follow what the city had done for years. And so, someone who comes to you is in a trap. The city takes a position based upon old law that has been superseded. And so that might matter here, but it certainly doesn't matter in Superior Court. That judge is going to apply the current state law that applies. And all zoning falls under state zoning procedures. They override anything that the city has on its books. I believe that Harold is right, that this does belong in Superior Court. Nonetheless, you do have the authority to look at the law, interpret the law. You have the authority to look at the evidence, apply the law to the evidence. You have that. The problem is it's just not clear that this is a decision of an administrative body. We know it's not. And so do you actually have the right to opine on it? Of course, you can opine on it. It just might be a nullity. And the judge says that was very interesting. But, the record might be interesting. The testimony might be relevant, but the actual decision is neither here nor there. Obviously, we're one way or another, we're going to find out. It's not that what Mr. Yellen said was wrong, but times have changed. And, my client is struggling trying to figure out how to do this. My client does not want to pay for multiple proceedings. My client would like to be told exactly where to go, what to do, and make the arguments and be done with it. But until this gets cleared up, there's just nothing else that we can do. Do you have any questions for me?
Are there any questions for Mr. Jones? Okay. No, sir.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Caitlin, have you all found out, was the ordinance changed prior to February the 12th, 2025?
I have a question for Edward, but it might be passed off to our zoning official.
Okay, go ahead and ask.
I know that you can have amendments to applications, building permit applications. Is the position of the city that the original application is the valid date of application? In other words, Mr. Jones showed us that there was at least three applications submitted as changes were made when Mr. Lynch submitted the applications for the various, there was a different owner, then there was the new owner. And so as it goes along, I know that traditionally the initial application, if a change is made, the date of the initial application is the valid date, not the dates that you submit the additional applications. Is that your understanding as well?
In my experience, speaking generally, the date of that initial application, that would be the application date, and subsequent modifications wouldn't necessarily change that. The distinction would be if for some reason you receive a new application number, that would be the indication that the previous application was no longer intended to be continued or that it had been withdrawn in favor of pursuing a different course of action. So yes, modifications of the same number would indicate an intent to carry on with that original application from its first date.
Because the applicant does not necessarily the owner of the building. The applicant is the architect. For example, Mr. Lynch was the applicant.
Contractor.
The owner can change.
Yeah,
but,
sure.
But if it's the same project, more or less, from beginning to the final application, the date of the original application is the one. Is that your understanding as well?
So then what is the date of the original application, if that's the position of the city? It would not be February the 12th.
No, it would be November of 24. Is that what you, is that, Mr. Lynch, can you come up, please?
But that would also be the one that did not show the property owner.
Okay, Matt. Mr. Lynch, what was the date of the original application that you submitted?
September of 2024.
September of 2024. All right, so it's...
See, the file number remained the same throughout the duration of the project. Obviously, I'd like staff to confirm that, but I think we checked that. It was one of the points of contention when we were here at the last appeal meeting before you, and I thought we had clarified it at that time.
It was a minute ago.
It was a minute ago, yes, sir.
If I was young like you, I remember.
Right.
All right. Any other questions?
I'd also like to just reiterate, I think that the documentation that Mr. Jones keeps showing you regarding the height issues was in a draft copy that he continues to show everybody as what was approved during the meeting. But if you look at, then again, staff can pull up the record of the drawing that was submitted and reviewed by HDBR, and it's not the drawing that he's showing you today regarding this elevator tower submission. So I just want to make sure everybody's clear on what the actual submission included.
That you're leading into my next question. The tower, the stair tower, is the city considering that, or are you considering that a mechanical space? Is that why it gets to go up above and the normal roof line?
Based on there's a mechanical screen wall that may or may not be required depending on the visibility of the equipment. So it was not shown in the submission because it's not part of height and mass. And we're not even sure that we're going to need it because of the how far we're setting the equipment back from the facade of the building. If it's not visible from the right of way, it's not required.
Might not be able to see it.
So, but it's our understanding, again, staff can confirm that that's not required to be shown if we're not sure we need to.
And what's your position on the fact that and roof line?
Again, that's something we met with staff multiple times in regard to, they were comfortable that we met the large scale standard. That was, I think, the reason that it was continued in the first submission that we hit, because there were some questions about that by one of the architects on the board, specifically in regard to the facade treatment, and so and how deep it was. And so we had made some modifications in the second submission to address those specific concerns on that Drayton Street side.
And you've done a number of buildings, I assume, that are on corners so that you have experience in this particular category.
Yes, sir. My partner served as the chairwoman of the HDBR for many years, so and on the staff on the board for many years. So we think we have a pretty good understanding of the requirements. And this is not a project that's been going on for a year plus. It's seen many eyes. We've met with staff at least a dozen times about it. We've met with Mr. Jones about it several times, other members of the public. So it's not something that was developed in a vacuum. Thank you. Ellen, I don't know if you have.
Come on, because Leah.
Yeah, Mr. Jones will have an opportunity.
Give him a chance.
There were a number of things mentioned by Mr. Jones, and I just want to point out that they're legal issues. Whether there's a Scrivener's error or not is a matter for the courts to take up. He mentioned that a text is retroactive. In my opinion, that's actually not the law in Georgia. The law in Georgia is vested property rights. That's the date of application. That's a legal matter, not something that should be before this tribunal. It should be before a judge. The only continuance he's asking for is one that's indefinite, and I don't see how that helps either side. Andrew and I do agree on something, that this has become very expensive. His client is spending large sums of money appealing every decision in our favor, and my client spending a large sum of money defending every appeal that Mr. Jones brings on behalf of Ballastone. To me, the only thing that makes sense now is let's put this whole thing under one roof, and that one roof is the Superior Court of Chatham County. Let's let the judge decide what goes where. We'll have direction from the judge. It's my understanding, and Andrew can confirm this, the Part 1 appeal is in front of Judge Benjamin Karp. The Part 2 appeal, which he's already filed to Superior Court, is also in front of Judge Benjamin Karp. Is that correct?
Not exactly.
No?
No, there's one petition in front of Judge Karp.
I'll respond. My understanding is the appeal that he made to the Superior Court of our Part 2, and I'm not a litigator. There are litigators in the room who can help me, but there's a 3.2 certification you have to file that says, is this matter similar to other matters that have already been filed? It would be hard for me to believe that the appeal of Part 2 wouldn't go along with Part 1. That would be the craziest thing I've ever heard of. So for this thing to become less expensive for both parties, which I think is what we're all looking for, I would urge you to deny this appeal, as you have denied the previous appeal, that all go before the Superior Court, and let's get some predictability. And that's all I have.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Mr. Jones, come please for your final rebuttal.
Certainly. The first petition was regarding Part 1. That was dismissed. The second petition is both Part 1 and Part 2. If we have to file a third petition, it will be almost duplicative because it's also Part 1 and Part 2. So my client is going to pay for something entirely duplicative, except it'll have to reference what happened in this proceeding. That makes it more expensive. If you just continue it until the judge gives some direction, then we'll know. If my client has to pay that extra money, then they're going to have to, but it's possible it's not necessary. We take a different position, of course, on the application. Our view is that if you file an application with an incorrect owner, the owner didn't change. The owner has always been Oglethorpe Avenue LLC from the beginning, and that's clear in all of our documents. But they pretended that the owner was this other business partner. So they changed the application because it was pointed out they didn't have a valid application, and potentially the application can be dismissed. I mean, if you file an application and it has things in it that aren't true, they really shouldn't be heard. So we don't believe that it's the same application. They might have given it the same number, but that's a pretty big exception to make for somebody. The other thing is that they went way beyond their 90-day continuance on the first one. They had an October hearing, and it got continued, and it never got rescheduled within the 90-day period. So usually that means you're done. And that, I think that's why they filed a new application on January the 1st. There is no grandfathering. I don't see any grandfathering provisions in the ordinance on this. So that if the law changes, you're going to have to conform to the new law. When I was doing my renovation, electric codes changed, and I had to pay for a code upgrade. That wasn't the code when I filed, but I had to pay for it. And the Scrivener's error is a real thing. So that is in that memo from Bridget Liddy that I showed you. She uses the term Scrivener's error. So that was the justification that City Council used to approve this. So it is the intent of the lawmakers that this is treated as a Scrivener's error and that it's retroactive. The Mechanicals, that is a stair tower and elevator shaft. It is not mechanicals. The mechanicals are that box on the top of the building. The Drayton Street, he says that the MPC was okay with the Drayton Street facade. Of course it was. The MPC was everything I'm objecting to, the MPC is happy with. This would become a very circular process if every time that there's a strong argument, you just have the MPC testify as to their interpretation, which was the interpretation in their original staff report, which was the copied in the decision, which is what I'm appealing. So it becomes fruitless to have an appeal if you're simply taking the what we're appealing as truth. You need to make an independent decision. Statute requires you to make that independent decision. The architect said, oh, I'm, you know, picking and choosing different graphics. But, you know, what I showed you was, in fact, the see if I can find that again. And I did this very carefully because I knew that this would be a concern. I'm not just choosing any graphic. There was one graphic in the HDBR May 15th decision, a view of the Oglethorpe facade. That is it. That's it. And we've got the copy of the decision. This is a snip from it. And then in the ZBA, it was cited in July 24th as the revised proposal HDBR approved. So yes, there's a lot of testimony that there, what happened was that there was a renderings by the architect, the ones on the left. Those are the ones the MPC reviewed. And then somehow right after the May 14th hearing, when I went into the file, there was a different submittal from the architect. I don't know whether he submitted it, on that day, a day prior, 2 days after. No idea, but it was not the one that the MPC reviewed. And the MPC presented this drawing to the HDBR, and this is the version that got into the decision. So I'm sure that the architect intended for the HDBR to look at that additional mass, but it was a mistake. There was a lot of confusion in the testimony. People weren't sure what they were looking at. And the HDBR signs their decisions, and hopefully they review them before they're issued. And they're responsible for what's in them. And when I appeal, I'm appealing a decision, the final decision. That's what the statute says. I'm not appealing the architect's submittal packet. I'm appealing the decision. And this is what the decision is. With that, unless there are further questions.
Can I ask you a quick question?
Oh, yes.
I want to. Okay. So your position is that it's what the staff puts in the final report that is the approved drawing, let's say, not necessarily what was submitted. So in other words, if staff, after the approval, even though the board saw the correct rendering, if the staff put the wrong picture in error in the final result, that that's the error that you're speaking
of. It's the error, and it should have been caught. I mean, it should have been caught when the chairwoman reviewed the decision before she signs it. When I sign things, I usually review them. And in that case, she should have just said, that's not the one. That's not the picture. Take that out, put the new one in.
Looks like we have two.
Yeah, well, if we keep having folks come up and interject, we've got to keep having Mr. Jones rebut it. I think we've kind of got to the end of needing any more testimony. Unless some of y'all object to that.
Edward just wants to say one thing.
All right. I just want to state that staff reports are not the means by which drawings are conveyed. Drawings are actually stamped after the fact. So what you see is purely there because staff is attempting to incorporate within its assessment the visuals that we are using and showing what we're applying standards to. Stamped plans are the means of conveying from one department to another, what it is that a petitioner actually intends to build, irrespective of what's in the report.
Okay.
Quick rebuttal.
All right, and that's it. No more interjections, yeah. No more.
But I'm not allowed to appeal drawings. I could appeal later on a building permit based on those drawings and saying the drawings weren't blah, blah, blah. But I'm appealing a decision. This is the decision. The fact that there are a bunch of other drawings behind the scenes is not relevant. If it were part of the decision, it should be in the decision. Thank you.
Mr. Jones.
Yes.
If this board issues a ruling, how long does your client have to file an appeal to this board's ruling? What's the ticking clock?
30 days.
30 days.
Okay.
All right. We're going to enter into board discussion.
Two.
I'm going to start out. I think Mr. Jones has made some very good arguments with lots of evidence. I haven't heard a lot of arguments against what he's been able to say that were really that good. It's possible that I think a continuance would be the best thing, and both sides seem to want that. Mr. Plunk, do you have anything you want to add?
I don't know that I would say both sides want a continuance. I think the other side does not. They want a decision so that it can go to Superior Court and get combined. But I understand both arguments. I mean, I was open to a continuance from the very beginning. There's just disagreement on, I guess, the best way to. Seems like both sides, you know, want to end this. They just disagree on the quickest way to get everything and the cheapest way to get everything to that end point.
Okay.
And I think everyone here agrees that whatever this board does is not the fine. I mean, we're trying to get this to the end point, and we're not it.
Mr. Bell? Court will be making a decision one way or the other.
Mr. Griffith, do you have anything you want to add?
Just that we need to get it to the court, that they're going to make the decision, regardless of what we do here.
All right, Mr. Condon.
I think that as we go through the three major points that Mr. Jones made, and Mr. Jones always does a very good job of presenting his client's case. I respect his ability to do that. I think it's standard in the city of Savannah that the date of the original application, modifications afterward don't change the date of the original application. So the first argument on the 50% building face kind of goes out the window, because at the end of the day, they submitted their application 2 months prior to that rule change. In the second piece, the roofline variation, the intent is for the face of the building. The face of the building is the Oglethorpe side, not the Drayton side. And so I think that's while it's an interesting argument, I don't think it's a correct one. And then the building form rule, I think it's a very fair and accurate thing to say that a shaft that contains an elevator is a mechanical space. So I don't, as much as I respect Mr. Jones, I don't think his arguments will hold water. And so I don't see a mistake that was made by the HDBR. The information that they received in terms of the packet that they reviewed was correct. I don't think that an error of somebody assembling the ruling to be signed requires that if there's an error in a photograph in that voids the whole thing. So that's just my two cents worth.
Okay, Mr. Turner?
I would be in favor of continuing it.
Okay. Mr. Ball?
I think I'd echo Mr. Condon's comments. That was well said. It seems like, you know, if we look at the flow chart that was presented, this all leads to Superior Court. Right. So if we continue this, it delays and adds further costs to this project, which is all going to the same place. So I guess continuing it, it's going to create a delay that will end up in the same place. I wouldn't be in favor of that.
Okay. Before I call for a motion, if someone makes a motion to continue, I think you should word it that it's continued until such a time as Superior Court makes a ruling, because we have to have an end date. Would someone care to make a motion?
Hang on.
Sorry, Edward Morrow, just a point of clarification. When someone makes a motion, if it is for approval or denial, please ensure that you state your reasons in support of that approval.
Absolutely.
Or denial.
Do continuances have to be date specific, or can we?
Yes. Yeah. They do.
It must be date specific. So it can't be.
Well, We've made motions before it until such time as the court makes a ruling. We did that here recently with, I think this, it was the parking garage when the judge sent the letter about having a stay on any proceedings to do with that property until, you know, until he had made a decision on it.
I don't remember that one off the top of my head.
It hadn't been that long ago. It's been this year.
Lost my memory. Staff is saying it has to be that. Do we just set it for, if we even get to that, that someone's making this motion, do we just set it for 90 days out? If that, it said it must be within 90 days. And then if we come to that point, you know, we can continue it again.
The issue basically is this, that if we continue it and the court dismisses it, then we have to do this whole thing all over again. So I would be in favor of making a decision today, one way or the other. If the court overrules us, so be it. They overrule us. But at the end of the day, I think that both sides have presented, you know, their arguments. You know, I've formed an opinion, and I'm ready to make a motion.
Well, make a motion, please.
I make a motion that we reject the appeal based on the fact that the information provided to us for the 3 points, the date of application, the roofline variation standard, and the building form, i.e. stair tower standards, were reviewed properly by the HDBR and the proper information was provided to them so that they could make a decision. I don't see an error.
All right, Mr. Condon has made a motion to reject the appeal based on the fact that the date of application, the roofline variation rule, and the building form rule was properly reviewed, and he doesn't see any errors. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Mr. Ball. Any discussion on the motion? All right, Mr. Ball, how do you vote?
Yes.
Mr. Plunk?
Yes.
Mr. Condon?
Yes.
Mr. Turner?
Yes.
Mr. Griffith?
Yes.
All right, motion passes and the appeal is denied. Next, we want to take just a short break so we can confer with staff for a minute. Sally, is everything straightened out with the Sages thing? Okay, let's just take a... All right, everybody's here. All right, y'all, settle down. We're gonna move on. Next, we're going to hear 502 Virginia Avenue, a variance to reduce side yard setback, 25-005375.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the board. My name is Sadie Ashler, Rental Development Services, here to talk about 502 Virginia Ave. So the petitioner is requesting a variance to reduce the side yard setback from 5 feet to 3.36 feet in association with the subdivision of a lot on an existing primary dwelling in the RSF6 zoning district. The existing single family dwelling will remain on one parcel, while a new lot line will create a second vacant lot. Before I go into this further, I'd like to explain a little bit more of the history that's happened here. I'll scroll down to current proposed subdivision. So a few months ago in October, this originally came in as an application to the MPC as variances to a general development plan. So originally the request was to subdivide, to put the lot line for the subdivision in a slightly different spot, to move it slightly a little bit closer to the east. And so with this request, they would have requested a lot area variance, a lot width variance, and then a rear yard setback variance. So currently, this existing dwelling faces or has a orientation towards Virginia Ave with that address. And so with that original request, this would have been a conforming lot in the RSF6 zoning district with 8,440 square feet. And this one would have been short of 6,000 with 5,340 square feet. Additionally, this would have had a lot width of 50 square feet and this of 80 square feet. And this would have had a rear yard setback difference as well. So it originally came in as a different request. After this came in, MPC staff and the petitioner discussed and modified the request to make it to improve the request and to lessen the ask. So that is why it is here before you at the ZBA. Changing the address orientation to Durant Avenue allows the lot to be conforming. So with this request, both lots will be over 6,000 square feet and have lot widths of 60 feet. So in the eyes of the zoning ordinance, they're both conforming lots within RSF 6. The only reason that we're here today and this request is necessitated is due to the current placement of the house. If it was placed 1 foot and some change closer to Virginia Ave, we wouldn't be here today because this specific side setback right here is what is being requested with this drawing of a new lot line. It needs to be 5 feet and it's just over 3 feet. Additionally, something that I want to mention that could be discussed with the reorientation of this current house is this unenclosed porch. So in RSF 6, the standard front yard setback is 20 feet, but if it has lane access, which this lot does, and if it is used from the lane, then the front yard setback reduces down to 15 feet. And so there's also a standard in the ordinance that says an unenclosed porch may encroach 8 feet further into that front yard setback. So I just want to point out that with a reorientation of the addressing to Durant Avenue, this meets the zoning ordinance standards and would not require an additional variance. So with that history in mind, I'll move forward with discussing a bit more of this current request. So it's located in the Gordonston neighborhood. The current dwelling on the property was built in about 1921 and has a building footprint of just short of 2,000 square feet. And this dwelling will remain. And there's also an accessory structure that the petitioner plans to demolish that I was last aware of. As mentioned, the proposal is to subdivide this into two lots, and they'll have square footage of over 6,000 square feet and will be conforming lots. And as mentioned, the current home currently has an address of Virginia Avenue and will reorient the frontage to Durant Avenue, which goes further in line with all of Durant Ave. And then this is the specific standard that we're requesting a variance from, the 5 feet. And then here's also showing a bit of the neighboring lots, showing the lot pattern of the sizes. You can also see behind Durant Avenue is this lane in the rear that sets it aside from Virginia Avenue. So all of these currently front Durant Avenue, so it would be in line with the development pattern for the orientation to be on Durant Avenue for this existing dwelling. So as the proposed subdivision, as mentioned, is generally consistent with the existing pattern of the single-family home development, MPC staff recommends approval of the requested variance. And then also, what I just want to mention, too, are a couple of the existing building photos. So this is the one from Durant Avenue. This is a bit of an older photo that we have from a Google Street View of Virginia Avenue, but you can see that on the slide as well, just for your reference when hearing other points of view. So as recommended, staff recommends approval of the variance, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for staff?
Sage's staff is here if you have any questions for them as well.
Okay. Go ahead.
What's the process for someone to change the orientation of the house? I'm not talking about the physical house itself. I'm talking about as far as the city is concerned, because I know it's not as straightforward as just saying, well, I want my address to be on Durant Avenue.
So to my understanding, it is a collaboration between development services and Sage's staff, depending on the type of dwelling there and where the house or the dwellings are oriented. And then Sage's staff determines if it would be appropriate address for that location.
Has Sage's staff been involved in this at all?
Yes. So the Sage's director is here, and she can answer any questions if you have.
I have a quick question for her, please. Good morning.
Good morning.
State your name for the record, please.
Lauren Hall.
Thank you, Ms. Lauren. So everything is copacetic with the idea of changing the address to Durant Avenue with you all?
Yes, because it's a corner lot. It would be appropriate to address it to either street.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions for staff? All right. Thank you. Would the petitioner please come forward?
Need some help pulling up my slides. This is touching.
Aaron and I dress alike all the time, not intentionally. And today we reversed it for y'all, by the way. I mean, every single hearing, we're in the same clothes. It's incredible. Thank you. Robert McCorkle here on behalf of the petitioner of Belford Renovations. My clients are here with me today. As was mentioned, the subject property is formerly known as, or currently known as, before the subdivision plan gets filed, is 502 Virginia Avenue. The lot itself is 13,780 square feet. It is 106 by 130 feet. It is the largest lot anywhere in the immediate area of the property in Gordonston. This is a picture from Durant Avenue. You can see here, and I'm just going to point this out while we're looking at the photos, that obviously the yard surrounds around the front here on Durant and onto Virginia. This is the adjacent lot. What we'll be creating, which you can obviously see here, has not been maintained as if it is part of the yard of the other property. It is looks like an undeveloped lot. This is a picture a little bit closer up from the other side. You'll see this property actually has two doors facing Virginia. It has one door facing the front, and or Durant, it has another door facing the lane. And then this is a picture of the adjacent lot itself. My client did originally file an application for a subdivision of this lot. And when they did, they were asking for three variances at the time. It was lot width on the new lot, lot area on the new lot, as well as a rear setback variance coming rear from Virginia. They filed that with the MPC because there were so many variances involved with it. That's where the staff wanted it to go. And so in some conversations they had on the site and otherwise with the neighborhood, it was, they heard that the neighborhood did not want to have a substandard lot approved in the neighborhood at 5,600 feet or whatever it was going to be. And so that's when they came to me. And so a lot of this procedural things that have happened are frankly because of me and so, and my work with staff. And so they came to me to sit down and talk about how we could try to address the neighborhood concerns and how to address the issues to allow the lot to be subdivided. My recommendation to them was that they in fact change the address to Durant in order to create two conforming lots so that we would remove this issue of setting some precedent for having non-conforming lots in Gordonston, even though I can take you on a tour around Gordonston, there are lots of lots that are under 60 feet wide and under 6,000 square feet, but we were trying to be accommodating to what was being requested. And frankly, the change of address makes sense. You've heard the staff has approved it. City has reviewed the subdivision plat. And like many times when we're asking for these variances, the only thing that's pending this being recorded and approved is the approval of this 19-inch variance, which we're here asking you for today. And the reason that the orientation makes sense, even though like she's already said it's approved, is that the original address, frankly, doesn't make a lot of sense. If you look at the lot numbers, I'm going to go a little bit in reverse here. I guess you can see the lot numbers here. If you look at the lot numbers, this is Durant. This is our property right here. You'll see that our house is lot number one on Durant. The lots run in numerical order, and they start with one, and they run all the way down the block, and then they cross the block, and they come all the way back, just like they do on normal block faces. So we are lots one, two, three, and four on Durant. The first lot number one on Virginia, sorry, I'm going to do a little bit differently. Lot number one on Virginia is this house, which is to the rear of us because it's on the other side of the lane. And so the original subdivision and the original laying out of the city's plans, our property was on Durant. It is lot numbered on Durant. And the house behind us on the other side of the lane is on Virginia. The dormers on the front of our house, they're small dormers. On the front of the house, you will also see that they face Durant. I think that's worth noting. Also, there was a former accessory building shed on this property that was built to the rear of our property along the lane, just as you would normally expect. You would also not normally expect a lane to run down the side of a house. You'd expect it to be just in the rear, again, where our shed was. And then I'll also point out that all the other corners that are in our immediate vicinity, none of them have Virginia addresses. All of them are turned internally to the streets that run east and west in the neighborhood, and I've written the names of the streets where they all orient. Additionally, if you go down to the other end of our block, when you get down to Durant and President, the houses, all the houses on the other end of the block are also all oriented interior to the east-west street. And so staff agreed with us in our proposal, they disagreed with us, and then so we move forward. So now what we're presenting to you is two conforming lots, which will allow us to subdivide this property. My clients are currently remodeling the old home, and they are going to either build or sell for someone to build an additional house next door. This is a great thing. It allows us to add a new neighbor and a new single family residence and an infill conforming lot in a historic neighborhood in Savannah. It's great. Infill single family housing is the number one desire to fight our housing crisis. And we've had a lot of discussions about that over the last few years as we've been up here seeking variances on lot widths. But in addition to the size of the lot itself being the largest lot in the area, the special condition that exists is, as was mentioned, the location of the house as it exists. As was mentioned by staff, if this house were 19 inches to the west, we would not have filed an application. There would be no public hearings. There would be no signs. There would be no hearings. We would have just recorded the subdivision plat, and this would already be done. The good news is that with a side yard setback variance, there's only one person who's affected ultimately, and that is the immediate neighbor. Usually when we come and ask for side yard setbacks, I live in a home that was built in the 30s on a 2-acre lot that actually has a side yard setback down to 3.5 feet, because over the years when people do additions and change historic houses, they creep into those setbacks and it works fine. And normally the way we do it is I would bring to you a letter of my neighbor saying, of course it's fine. And because they're the only person that's affected by this. Nobody else knows whether my house is is less than a foot varied in the front, less than 2 feet varied in the back corner. No one else could possibly know that except for the immediate neighbor. Even better news, we're the immediate neighbor. When we subdivide this lot, we are creating a standard lot next door. So whoever buys the house that is built there will know what they're getting into when they buy their house. They will know that this house is only between 4.5 feet and 3.5 feet away from their property line. And so there is no one harmed by this at all. And they're certainly not harmed by what address is on our mail. And so we believe this was an elegant solution to this issue that would resolve the neighborhood's concerns about lot area. And so we refiled the application. We withdrew our application, refiled with the ZBA, asking for this single 19-inch variance. We had asked to have a meeting with the neighborhood. There was some discussion about having a meeting. It was supposed to be on November 13th. We had a set time. I believe it was 4 o'clock. On November 10th, we received an email saying that was included with staff, basically saying we desire to keep this meeting closed. And so we were disinvited from attending the neighborhood meeting about it. So I don't know what was said there, but I tried to send an email back to the neighborhood and to the individuals that were emailing saying, this is why we did this. This is not a non-conforming lot. This is only 19 inches. We're happy to talk to you about it anytime. We'll come to any meeting you want to have. And we were never requested to return to another meeting. But obviously there are lots of signatures that were supplied to you objecting to our variance here today. And those petitions, some of them say that it is a petition that objecting to our subdivision creating a non-conforming lot, which of course is not accurate. It does not create a non-conforming lot. Several of the signed petitions are about the previous application and talk about our rear line setback and lot area variance, other things that don't apply. You would get the impression by reviewing that perhaps we were trying to do something that's not consistent with the existing conditions of the neighborhood. I'm sure everybody's driven through Gordonston and you're familiar with it. But I think it's important to note that actually protruding into the side yard setback probably is the existing prominent condition in Gordonston, primarily, again, because people have added accessory buildings. They've added additions onto homes over the years, and all of these are creeping into, and many of the houses are zero lot line. I drove around the neighborhood. I did a lot of research on this. I could show you over 50 houses in the neighborhood that are essentially zero lot line and less than what we are asking for on the variance. But for the purposes of not making this another hour and a half presentation for y'all, I'm going to focus on our particular block face in our immediate surrounding area. This is the immediate surrounding area around our house. This is the house here on the corner. All of those blue lines are buildings, either in prominent primary structures or accessory buildings. There are zero lot line, or essentially zero lot line to the property. There are people who have fenced in the lanes. There are accessory buildings constructed in the lanes. There are properties that overhang property lines. It is a common condition. But rather than go around all of these, which again, I'm not going to do, I do want to show you just our block. So this is our block face. If you look at this photo, This is actually across the street. So this is Durant running right here. Okay. This is across the street from us. You can see here, and I know Sage's lines are not exact, but if you look at it, if you actually slide the Sage's lines over to try to make the property not on over the property line, then it actually covers on the other side because again, the houses are zero lot line. I'll show you some pictures. These are directly across the street. You can see here, this house here is zero lot line. This house here and the construction, the building in the back are zero lot line. This house here has a protruding edge over here that is zero lot line. And just to show you the pictures, because this is what commonly happened or close to zero lot line. So what's commonly happened in the neighborhood is people have gone in, whether they were permitted or not, whether they sought variances for their 5 feet or not, I don't know. But these are the common conditions. These are the houses in the pictures that were just shown. You can see here, this is actually the fence line for the yellow house, and you can see the eaves of the house next to it actually hang over. So you got about an 18-inch side yard setback there between the houses. This is one that's a very common, which is directly across the street from us. So here you've got the width of maybe that's 10 feet between the houses, but you've also got accessory buildings that have been constructed zero lot line. In many of the places in the neighborhood, they actually overlap each other. I don't know which one's over the lot line, but they overlap. So those are all zero lot line, again, directly across the street. This is on our side of the street. Here you've got about 6 fence slats. Maybe that's 30 inches, less than 3 feet of total distance to the property line. And then I want to look at the immediate 2 houses next to us, because I think even though we've got people objecting to this variance on the side yard setback that may live blocks away, the 2 people that are immediately next door to us probably perhaps could be argued the most people that would be most likely to affect it. I know Mr. Ziegler owns a house next to us, has objected and helped kind of, we've had some correspondence back and forth. This is Mr. Ziegler's house right here. Our house, this is our lot line. That will be our empty lot right here. And just so you see, this is the accessory building garage that's in his house. It is zero lot line, both on the side and the rear. Perhaps it's over, I don't know. But it's zero lot line for sure. And I'll show you the picture of it from the side. This is the neighbor next to them, again, built into the lane, fenced into the lane. This is an addition that appears to have been done at a house at some point in time that is over the Sage's lot line, but it's clearly zero lot line on the front. No setback at all. This is a photo of the immediate 2 lots that I was just showing you next door. So this is Mr. Ziegler's garage here, which you can see basically overhangs the fence line between the property. This gap here, usually these trash cans are here, and you can't see around the trash can. So whatever the width of a trash can is. And then they've also got an accessory building back here in the back. And I show all that not because I'm suggesting that any of these people have done anything wrong, because I don't think any of them have done anything wrong. I'm not suggesting that they have. I'm suggesting to you that the predominant condition, both on our street and on the neighborhood, is that this 5-foot setback has been encroached upon up and down the street. Again, I could give more than 50 examples. And the majority condition is actually less than 5 feet or zero lot line, both on our block and in multiple places in the neighborhood. And so we believe that what we're asking for, which is an attempt to, one, leave this 1920s home and exact the location it is, two, satisfy the neighborhood by having actual fully conforming lots divided here, so that, and then three, allow us to build a single family infill residence to add to the neighborhood in Gordonston. You're probably going to hear a couple of items. One, you're going to hear that this is a historic district or that this is a contributing structure home. We're not making changes to the home as far as a contributing structure. We're not trying to tear it down. This is not a local historic district. I don't know whether it's tried to apply for in the past, but it is not. There is no oversight over this district. There is no architectural review. We don't have to go before some HRB to get approval of what we're doing or approval of the subdivision of the lots. It is not a historic district as far as the city of Savannah is concerned. The second one is my clients removed a shed that was a workspace in the back. It was one of those, it was a structure that had the opening door, so you put your lawnmower in there and then had work tables back in the back, a workshop table. And so when they originally applied for their plans that were approved by the city of Savannah, the plans that were ultimately approved, the shed wasn't shown because they thought they probably were going to have to tear it down depending on how it worked out. They were going to try to save it. Ultimately, they ended up making the decision to tear it down. They tore the shed down. Neighbors called the city dial 311, city came out, stopped them from tearing the shed down, or stopped them, tagged them after they had torn the shed down. Through that process with the city, they obtained the permit to tear the shed down. They worked with both. They had asbestos people come in and make sure there wasn't asbestos. They worked with the city and the EPD to address any lead paint issues that might have needed to be addressed. They did everything by the book, and they ultimately removed the shed from the property. And so that shed that was here that was backed up to the lane is no longer there. So, again, what we're asking for today is a simple singular variance. I'm not asking to approve an address change, not asking to approve a lot variance request, or a lot area request, or any of those other things. We are asking for a singular variance of 19 inches on the rear corner of our property to allow us to have this subdivision put in place. I contend to you again, there is not a single human being who is affected by this in any way except for our lot, which we own, and we support the recommendation. And we have staff's recommendation for approval as well. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions and also hope that y'all will give me a minute to rebut whatever is said.
And any questions for Mr. McCorkle? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're entering the public comment. Charlotte Landon, are you here? Would you like to speak? Come up and state your name for the record, please. And we're glad to hear what you had to say.
Yes, my name is Charlotte Landon, and I live at 514 Virginia Avenue. I've been there since 2009. I chose to live in Gordonston because it is a unique neighborhood, both in design and character. The Gordonston Historic District is listed on the National Register of Historic Places. 121 properties were identified as contributing buildings to this designation. 502 Virginia, built in approximately 1921, is one of those. Gordonston, designed by J.G. Langdon in 1917, incorporated a neighborhood landscape where there were, quote, no longer lawn rows of closely packed facades, but residential parks of individual homes. 502 Virginia is a craftsman-style bungalow centered on a large anchoring corner lot with a clearly defined front door on Virginia Avenue, a sweeping semicircular brick entrance also on Virginia, and a spacious rear yard. It defines the concept of a house integrated into a park-like landscape. When the petitioner purchased this property, the placement of the structure was obvious. No attempt was made by the petitioner during renovation to alter the size or basic appearance of the house. To now claim that its placement is a hardship, to propose a reorientation of its front entrance, and to divide the property into two smaller lots by amputating its yard, not only contradicts Langdon's original intent, but jeopardizes the historic plan for a neighborhood unique to the city of Savannah. Additionally, I would like to note that the ZBA application for this variance identifies the property as 501 Durant. That address, according to Sages, does not exist at this moment. Sages identifies the property as 502 Virginia, and I oppose the granting of this variance. Thank you.
Thank you. Roy Ogletree.
Good afternoon. I'm Roy Ogletree. I'm in the residence at 202 Atkinson Avenue in the neighborhood in Gordonston. I'm an architect, a builder, and a developer. So I am pro-development, but I'm only pro-development when it makes sense and it follows the standards in place. So what we've got here is a situation where a corner lot is bigger than some of the adjacent lots. The property owner wants to subdivide off part of the property. And all that makes sense if it meets the standards. Problem is it doesn't meet the standards. The reorientation of the house, that all sounds good in words here. Oh, let's just reorient the house. Well, it was built in 1921, oriented to Virginia Avenue. You can't change that fact on the ground. So changing the address does not change the orientation of the house. The rear yard is the rear yard on this house, and the rear yard setback is 20 feet. So what they're asking for in this application is a side yard variance that does not apply because it is not the side yard of this residence. And the staff report, I appreciate the staff. I've done work downtown before and had lots of good situations, not with this current staff, but with previous staff. And I appreciate their job, but in this case, they've done a flawed report. They've allowed it to be considered a different orientation, and then they call that a side setback, and it's neither one. The house is oriented to Virginia Avenue, as it always has been. The rear yard is 20 feet setback requirement, and I didn't have this submitted, but you can even see it from there. This orange stripe is the setback that should be required, which is the 20-foot rear setback, and it's right through the middle of the house. And then in the report, like I say, it has a lot of flaws in it. It's talking about the hardship. There is no hardship on this property owner except his own financial hardship. The house was placed, they talk about the house being placed there. Well, the house has been there since its origin at 1921. This didn't just get placed there recently. So there's no hardship involved. By granting this, there would be a financial benefit to the homeowner, and there would be a preferential treatment to the homeowner considering that it doesn't meet the requirements. I think that pretty much covers it. Do you have any questions?
No, sir. This is just a time for public comment.
Okay.
It's hard to read some of this writing. Collis Neely?
I apologize for my handwriting. I'm Collier Neely. I'm the CEO for the Historic Savannah Foundation. So this was recently brought to our attention, just paying attention to what's going on in Gordonston. Mr. McCorkle is right. This is not a local historic district. However, there are efforts being made right now as we speak to turn this into a conservation district. Being listed to the National Register, Gordonston is significant because it continues this the importance of Savannah in American urban design and urban planning with the radial plan that exists there. Virginia Avenue and 502 Virginia Avenue are part of that plan and a part of the land use that exists in Gordonston, and its orientation to Virginia is a part of the unique character that exists within Gordonston itself. At the same time, admittedly, like, there is kind of a chaotic development pattern in Gordonston. That's a part of what's going on here, though, because we're implementing a particular style of urban design in an environment that is used to the Oglethorpe plan. And seeing that integrated into what Gordonston is now, what we understand Gordonston to be, is a part of the historic pattern of development. So there's going to be irregularity where it exists. I want to make sure that y'all understand that. I'm standing up here saying that I'm opposed to this particular application. But I just want to make sure that y'all understand that part of Gordonston's historic pattern of development is kind of chaos. So I do generally agree with Mr. McCorkle's assessment on that. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. And Robert, Trithad.
Robert Trithart. I live at 514 Virginia. So my house is oriented exactly the same as the house at 502 Virginia. The request, as I read it, is being made by the 502 Virginia, and that the requested setback reduction would apply to the parcel containing the existing dwelling. If in fact that is the dwelling at 502 Virginia, we are not looking at a side variance. We are looking at a rear variance. So you're changing the rear setback variance from the required 20 feet to 3.5 feet. That seems to be significantly different. This is not a side variance setback. It's a rear setback. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, Patrick Connell.
Thank you. Thanks for letting me speak. Ziegler Gordon.
Ziegler Gordon.
Yep.
Oh, you're representing Mr. Ziegler.
Yep. Yep. Patrick Connell on behalf of Albert Ziegler, who lives in that lot right behind where the new lot would be. You'll see this map here. I think this is awesome. But I'm a nerd about old maps, particularly land use related. And I think this was particularly attractive. As has already been addressed, it's a national historic neighborhood recognized as such because not just the structures themselves, but the layout of the neighborhood itself and the use of certain design principles in the design of the neighborhood by a landscape architect, which to me was a bit of a surprise. I went to undergrad for landscape architecture, and I didn't know it was really even referred to as such in this area at the time. But here's a comment, I think, here on page 6. Elin Drummond wrote, "The landscape associated with a house in a properly planned garden is as important as the house itself." And that was the idea behind the layout of Gordonston. It was getting out of tightly spaced, more urban development that you saw in the townhouse and some brownstones that were downtown into an area where the breeze would blow between the buildings. And that's literally part of the National Register's recognition of the significance of the Gordonston Plan, which, you know, while the city has not yet put this into a conservation district, and although there are plans to do so by the neighborhood who I've met with, and they're very earnest about this, and it's moving along parallel to this process to oppose this subdivision. The city certainly does recognize the fact that Gordonston is, in fact, a significant contributor to the city as a historic area where the history of the development of Savannah is something that we tout as important and we do try to preserve. So it's interesting to me that when we get into this application, there's a certain amount of, I don't know what to call it, willful blindness to the fact that there is a front yard to this house and a backyard. There is. I don't know how we get ourselves to a place where we need to cut off a lot to help finance a development that's gone poorly in the renovation of a house, and to do so that we go ask for everyone down at the MPC to say that, well, this is, we can just call this the side yard. And we can get around the fact that we need not a 19-inch variance, but an 18 foot variance. This is Mr. Ziegler's property. He's paid me to be here. That's how much he cares. First, though, are we even in the right place? Because this is from the subdivision standards, which would apply to this. Resubdivision of lots there at Section C says to be developed as a unified whole, not further subdivided. If such resubdivision creates lots of such size or shape, which would alter or change the character of a recorded single family subdivision. This one was recorded a long time ago, one of the first planned subdivisions recorded in Savannah. So to get past this, we actually need a variance. But to get a variance for this, you need to go to the MPC. Why? Well, in the subdivision ordinance says the MPC shall be authorized to vary such requirements. And in the zoning ordinance where it spells out the ZBA's authority, it says you can grant variances only to those standards that are not within the purview of the MPC. This is not just a setback variance. This is the creation of a new lot to the detriment of an existing lot, which now will not meet the standards that are applicable to it for design. That goes to the MPC, I believe. Notwithstanding, here we are. And this just goes to further show that the staff's view of this plan says the subdivision variance is based on the particular shape of the lot and their and unusual circumstances. That's the standard they're supposed to address. And it says the placement of the existing single-family structure presents a hardship. Well, it's only a hardship because it orients towards Virginia, and there's not enough room for a setback if we put this lot line 18 inches, 19 inches, from what is the natural rear of the structure, where, by the way, the utilities are located. I can pull up a picture on Sages and show you that the existing HVAC unit will actually cross the property line. And the gas meter is dead on it. At least that's what I eyeball. If it doesn't cross it, it's darn sure close. And you can actually go look at the Google map images that are presently, when you drop a little man and he walks the street. Well, I've looked at it yesterday to see if I could avoid going back out there for a finer point. And it's a November 2025 picture. Imagine that. They just updated. So you can actually look on Google Maps and see where they have flagged where this will be, because we've had surveyors out there, and that's important. We'll get to that in a minute. And you can see the edge of the HVAC system. And while I didn't go out there and tape it myself, it's darn close, but I would bet a fair amount of money it actually crosses. Special conditions or circumstances do not result from the actions of the applicant. I've seen this question answered a lot of times before this very body, and I can't discern any reasonable way to differentiate this from so many other requests where this answer has been answered a little more affirmatively in the, yeah, that's what happened here. They bought a property to renovate, not to subdivide. And if they had bought it to subdivide, they surely didn't have any meeting with staff ahead of time. And they got well into the renovation and then decided to subdivide. And realized that, well, we can't just subdivide. We got to get a variance. And they don't plan to live there, I don't believe. So you're taking someone who's doing this to make a profit in a neighborhood that has existing people who live there who don't want it in their neighborhood. Granted, I mean, there are reasons to grant that variance, but in this situation where you've got a neighborhood plan that is significantly historic because of the way the lots were laid out, and you got a subdivision ordinance that says we don't want to create new lots via subdivision that don't meet the requirements of the subdivision ordinance, and you got a house that faces that way, but you need to believe it faces that way to get the relief requested. I just struggle with why this isn't the special conditions or circumstances that will result from the actions of the applicant in this instance, when in other cases, it certainly has been the applicant's fault and the variance has been denied. The $2 million question. The front of the house, where is it, guys? Can you see it? This picture here, Virginia Avenue, 1940. Front yard is the area between the front property line and the front facade of the building. Which one of those is the front facade, guys? I think it's that one. Is that the front door or is that the front door? I heard staff say that in response to Mr. Condon's question, that it was the joint opinion of Sages and the development department to determine whether the house could be reoriented. Well, here's an email from John Agadnost, who should play a part in that. I didn't see it presented by staff. I haven't heard it referenced. But John Agadnost says, in my opinion, the subdivision does not change the orientation of the existing house. Duran is the front. The existing porch does not appear to meet the encroachment standard because it looks like it encroaches more than 8 feet into the 20-foot setback. Ah, but we got a lane. We got a lane. So we get to go to 15 feet. Let's look at the lane. Have we done anything to determine whether the lane's really usable here? It's tongue-in-cheek, but are we getting the cart before the horse? Because here's the lane. There's the new proposed lot. The lane certainly doesn't go all the way through anymore. Here's the lane. Are we going to improve it? I mean, I think there's an argument that it's closed or abandoned or some... I don't know if abandoned probably has a definition, and I see that it is still marked as right-of-way on Sages. But is it truly usable? Is that tree in the way? Is it substandard? Have we talked with traffic about that? Because I think we probably need to before we determine whether or not we're traveling under a 20-foot front yard setback if you say that Durant is the front yard, or a 15-foot one. Because if you're at a 20-foot one, then you need a second variance for that unopened porch. Here's just a reference to the difference if you have a lane and if you don't. And that's just the additional variance that you can get without getting a variance, but the additional amount of room that you can move into the lane. I mean, not into the lane, into the setback from for an unenclosed porch, 8 feet into the required front setback, which is, we would argue, actually the side setback. These are the questions that I have. Why are we bending over backwards? Who's benefiting and who is suffering here and at what cost? Neighbors are fairly adamant that this is a noteworthy feature. It's a lot that was created in accordance with a plan that is recognized for the design of the lots. The request requires you to suspend something, not really disbelief, but to ignore the fact that the front of the house and the side of the house is the side of the house. To disagree with John Agadnost, who says that the subdivision is not going to reorient the house. The house faces the way that it faces. What is the precedent set by this? There's a lot of large lots in Gordonston. Some of them on corner lots. If they want to get a buildable lot, can they just come in and say the front's the side's front? Or do they need to be, you know, at least ask for the 18-foot variance for the rear yard? So we're dealing with, you know, what's actually on the ground out there and has been for nearly 100 years.
Thank you. Thank you. Before we hear the rebuttal, I've got a question for staff. Has this lot already been subdivided, or is it proposed to be subdivided?
It's my understanding that the subdivision is pending upon this.
So it's correct. Currently not, which would mean the address has not been changed, but it's been proposed to be changed.
Correct.
Thank you. Any other questions? Mr. McCorkle, would you like to rebuttal?
I've been doing this a long time. I appear in front of y'all a lot. This is one of the strangest applications and deals I've ever dealt with for something that is so small. Everybody in the neighborhood seems to be super concerned about rear yard setbacks and super concerned about side yard setbacks, that we are fundamentally changing Gordonston. I showed you the pictures. I can go back to mine, but I'm going to leave this here because I think it's interesting that the historic map they are demanding we stick to has 30-foot lots. We'll leave that there. But I showed you all the pictures, and I can go back through them. But the idea that we're protecting the neighborhood because it's where breezes are supposed to blow between the houses, I suspect that you saw those pictures. Not a lot of breeze blowing through a lot of those houses. And a lot of the individuals who are being represented here today, including our immediate neighbor next door, has an accessory building in the lane, zero lot line, both side yard and rear yard. So if we're super concerned about the 20-foot rear yard setbacks destroying the fabric of Gordonston, why are we building accessory buildings in those setbacks, both directions? It makes no sense. The couple that spoke from 514 Virginia, and I can show you their house too, their accessory building is zero lot line at the head of their garage on their property line. So everyone who's here, I was going to go by individual names to show all of the encroachments, but I decided not to do that. But the people that are objecting have benefited more from the exact same request that we're making, but they're all here today objecting to my client getting the same benefits they already have when they built their additions or added on to their homes or did all of these things. So I don't know why we're concerned about side yard and rear yard setbacks for us in this particular lot, but we're not concerned about it on any other lot in Gordonston. The HSF is here today, which is also interesting, because another thing that's interesting is what no one asked. You know what no one asked? And when they turned us down from going to the meeting so we could present to them what we were going to do, what nobody's asked is, what are you going to build on that lot you're putting in there? All these people are super concerned about what their neighborhood looks like and protecting the historic nature of it. Not a single soul that spoke mentioned that they don't like what our guys are doing, or no one's even asked us to see plans for what we're going to do because they don't care. This has nothing to do with rear yard setbacks and side yard setbacks, which HSF said was there's chaos in this neighborhood. And he's absolutely correct. And I would think HSF would be supportive of my client, given that there's been a lot of discussion about orientation of building. You know what we're not doing? We're not destroying the historic fabric of a 1921 house. We're changing the address on the envelopes that are going to come to their mail. That's what we're changing. The facade of the house, which everyone wants to protect, is being completely protected by my client. And in fact, they got a lot of comments about the fact this house was in terrible disrepair when they bought this property. And so they are putting a 1921 home back in great shape, which should be being applauded. And what they're asking for here is the same discretion that has been given to virtually everyone else in the neighborhood so that they can have a completely conforming lot. We're not supposed to go to MPC because the lot, we're not asking to break these subdivision ordinances. The subdivision ordinance requires us to have a certain lot area and lot width, which we do. This is a setback variance on a building, which is a different thing, which comes to you. And so we are absolutely in the right place. The city has reviewed this and approved it. Again, you can look at this lot. We're talking about we should never be recombining lots. You know what's interesting about our lot? It's 130 feet. So we have a neighborhood that was designed with 30-foot lots. If you look at this drawing in front of you, you will see our lot here on the corner. And I believe, and I've seen this map, and I believe that the original lot was actually 60 feet wide and then 30 feet all the way down. So every single person that lives on Durant has recombined at some point from when this original plan that we can't touch now has been done. Some of those lots aren't even 60 feet. Our lot added additional footage, added two more lots, and added additional footage at some point in time after this plan was done. So that plan has changed, and we're not asking to go back to the historic nature. We're not asking to go back to 30 feet. We're asking to meet the standards as they currently exist. We think that infill single-family residential housing is fantastic. We think the city should be doing what they can do in order to provide places to build that. This is not somebody's backyard. You saw the picture. This is a vacant lot that's sitting here. We're going to build, or there will be built, a new house on it, and we'll add a new neighbor and a new memberhood of the neighborhood association. And we hope that neighbors, even that live blocks away from there, are not affected by the fact that our house is going to be 3.5 feet from the property line instead of 5. And so, again, city has reviewed and approved the, we did, Mr. Anagos email, by the way, real quick. We did ask for the address to be approved, changed. It was approved. And then we were asked to go back and remeasure the porch to make sure that Mr. Anagos email was addressed. And we provided all the measurements and all that was approved. So all we're here asking for today, again, is a 19-inch variance on the side yard setback. Y'all approve this variant, support staff's recommendation, supports the city's finding, Sagus's finding, everybody else has looked at this, and we'll go forward and add another housing unit to the availability in Savannah. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions you got.
Where are you at in the process of the subdivision and the address change?
So the address change is approved. What's waiting on is just this variance. If this variance gets approved, then we go file the subdivision plat and it's changed. Because again, as I showed earlier, I mean, as an example about talking about orientation. Yeah, the front door was facing Virginia, but and it's a solid door instead of two doors. So maybe the door they chose makes a difference on how it's oriented, but it doesn't change the fact that the lot numbers are lot 1 through 4 on Durant, and that there is a lane to the rear, and that the shed, which is I don't think you'd see any other accessory dwellings on any of those photos, that were on the side of people's properties, up on the side. They're in the rear of people's yards on the lane, which is where our shed was, because the reality is, and as is drawn on this very pretty map in front of you, all those lots are oriented to Durant, not to Virginia. And so it's been approved. If y'all approve the variance today, we'll file the subdivision, get it signed, file it, and move forward.
I think you've made some great arguments. My concern was that how do we approve a side yard setback for a side yard that does not yet exist?
We've been through this every way we can go through it. When we originally applied, then when we got the change of address approved, we came back and changed the application and made it Durant. Then there was an objection that the sign said it was on 501 Durant and that's not a current address. So then we went back and postponed it to re-advertise and to show the signs to show it as Virginia. It has to go one way or the other. Either I'm here asking for a rear yard variance that really is going to be a side yard variance when you approve it, or I have to come here asking for a side yard variance that then when we file the subdivision plat. But the process we normally go through with these things is we send the subdivision plat to staff and to the city. They look at it. They make comments. They set the addresses, all those things. And they come back to us and say, we're ready to sign this, except you need this variance. And so this was the variance that's come back to us. So, yes, the address that currently is in the system is going to be different, but they've already blessed both the subdivision plat and the address change as long as we can get the variance. So I think procedurally it's the correct way to do it.
Okay. Are there any other questions for the applicant? All right. Thank you very much. I'm going to enter into board discussion, and I'd like to start by saying if there's a motion to approve the variance, maybe it could be made contingent upon the subdivision and the address change being approved, possibly. Mr. Ball, do you have anything you'd like to add?
Yeah. Seems like there's a few remedies available. This is the obvious one, get a variance to grant the 19-inch variance. Alternatively, they could pick the house up and move it. Variance. They could also tear the house down.
Yeah.
Which, you know, would be terrible. So I would think that in light of all of that, I'm in favor of granting the variance.
All right, Mr. Plunk?
No.
Mr. Condon, you have anything to say?
Gordonson is a very special neighborhood. It's a beautiful place, and I can understand why people would fight over it. I get it. You know, my daughter lives in Gordonson. We're in board discussion. My daughter lives in Gordonson. I'm there all the time. It's a beautiful place. And it's only natural that people fear the unknown. I get that. But the reality is these gentlemen are going to build something there. And they're going to build it because they're either going to move the house or they're going to tear the house down and they'll build two new houses. That's what they'll do. They're in the real estate development business. That's why they bought the house. So we can hope for the best, but it's naive to think that they're not going to do anything. That's my 2 cents worth.
Mr. Turner.
I agree with everything Mr. Condon said. No further comment.
Mr. Griffith.
No, I do. I've lived in Gordonston. I agree that it's a chaotic neighborhood. I don't think that this application is going to disrupt that and, you know, put another lot on the roll. So I'm all right with it.
Would someone care to make a motion? No, sir. We're in board discussion. There's no more comment from the public.
I move that we grant petitioner's request.
All right. Mr. Plunk has made a motion to grant the petitioner's request. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Mr. Ball. Is there any discussion on the motion? Mr. Turner, how do you vote?
Yes.
Mr. Griffith?
Yes.
Mr. Condon?
I'm going to abstain because I think I have a conflict.
Okay. Mr. Ball?
Yes.
And Mr. Plunk?
Yes.
All right. Motion passes and the variance is approved. There is no other business before us, so we will be adjourned.